This is Mark Strassman, reporter with Utopia Media's Medical News Network. We're about to speak with Dr. Evan Snyder at the Burnham Institute of the Burnham Institute in La Jolla, California. Welcome back to Utopia Media's Medical News Network.
Thanks for inviting me back.
The last time we spoke, a few weeks ago, it was still a matter of some speculation how inaccurate it would be to say that Dr. Huang's stem cell publications were accurate. We discussed that, and you said that if it turns out that it was faked, we'd pretty much be back at the beginning in terms of the research he was working on. How convinced are you at this point that the research that was reported in Science Magazine is was fabricated and didn't really reflect the breakthrough that it was purported to be?
I think now with investigation it becomes clear, and Dr. Huang is pretty much admitted that all of the data in that 2005 Science publication was fabricated. I think he may still contend that perhaps two of those may have been accurate, but there's no way to even begin to verify it. And the material that's left really does not change or convince anybody that 100% of all of the data presented was false.
Okay. Now, there are two main topics we're going to discuss, but before we do that, I wanted you to sort of follow up on your comments from our last conversation about the importance of embryonic stem cell research and particularly somatic cell nuclear transfer in the generation of customized stem cell lines through that process for developing models for the development of diseases and how to study them in the laboratory, as opposed to generating stem cells that would be used in therapy to replace damaged nerve or muscle or heart or other types of cells. Could you comment on and elaborate on that point first for us?
Sure. I think I want to emphasize, too, that nuclear transfer is just one minor aspect of the field of stem cell research. It's one particular technique, one particular tool, which is why, the field is not, is in no way stalled significantly by this. I think we're all horrified that a scientist would do this. But, as you know, there are rogues in every field, including science, and very often they get drawn to areas that are very high profile, very highly exposed, and this one particular technique had been a technological hurdle that just required an enormous amount of man hours, people hours, and was very labor intensive. He had the funding to be able to throw a lot of resources at it, and therefore he was able to acquire supposedly, purportedly, the skills to be able to do this one technique, and therefore he would have been the go-to people for the field.
Although apparently, if you're going to fake something, why bother to put a lot of effort into it? He could have done it on a smaller budget and with less staff if he was going to make the stuff up, wasn't he? Couldn't he?
Just as well, that's a very interesting question. I think that I don't think his intent was to deceive.
Right.
And in fact, there's some suggestion that the paper that he did on the cloned dog might actually be accurate. So he had a Nature paper where he cloned a dog.
Right, Snuffy.
And while the jury is still out on that, that may be accurate. He may have actually done that. And, the 2004 paper, where he first announced that he could make a line that was a clone line, we don't know if that's true or not, but, that may have been a success.
Okay.
The techniques that he used are going to be very difficult to verify.
In terms of Snuppy, the cloned Afghan hound, isn't it a relatively simple matter to take a genetic sample from the alleged donor animal and from the allegedly cloned animal, and if they're identical, then in fact, Snuppy is a cloned Afghan.
Right. I'm not as familiar with the details of that case. However, I've heard simply through the grapevine, so put it in its proper context, that that particular strain of dog is so heavily inbred that it may, that some of the results may not be entirely as clear cut as you might, as you might expect.
In other words,
you know, it will be, it'll be scientists policing themselves that will investigate this.
Okay. The two main things I wanted to talk about are the implications of about this for the scientific enterprise in general, and then in particular, what this means for the future of stem cell research. Why don't we talk to the talk about the first point first? In our discussion last time, I guess I raised the issue of who exactly is in charge of determining the validity of scientific research, and I sort of guessed that it was a Science Magazine or peer. Peer-reviewed publications in general, is that still the case, or is the important point that the scientific community needs to be able to see how experiments are done and replicate them, and if they're replicated, then they'll stand as a source of new information, and if they're not, then the original conclusions are excluded from the ongoing canon of the scientific information. What does this mean for that process? Will there have to be more or different checks and balances, or has the enterprise become so globalized and so diffuse that it's hard to use the existing system anymore? What kind of comments do you have about that?
Well, actually, I would say that the system worked. Basically, this all was brought to light by the scientific community policing itself. Now, there's various stages in which scientific knowledge makes it into the literature. For very prestigious magazines, journals, the peer review process is very, very onerous. You go through many, many reviews and then through the editors and things of that sort. But that, again, is step number one, and that usually screens out most problems. Now, if a scientist is exceedingly clever and has really been steeped in the process of peer review, he knows how to fool the process. You know, he knows how to fool his peers.
Do these peers have to rely on his reports of, I took X chemical and mixed it with Y chemical and I did this? They don't send forensic pathologists over to the lab to check everything he says, do they?
No. You know, initially, science is based on trust, like any kind of enterprise. It's kind of like your taxes.
Right.
You know, before you fill out your taxes, you don't have the government sitting going through the receipts with you. What they do is they trust that what you're submitting is an accurate reflection of your deductions and things of that sort.
Right, although for most people, of course, the employers are required by law to report the income to the government, so they do have some sort of second channel there.
Well, they do, but, you know, somebody who is intent to deceive the system, an accountant who really knows the system, can fool the initial first layer of scrutiny.
Right.
But ultimately, again, there could be some red flags. And initially, a good reviewer can catch certain red flags. Now, one of the red flags that should have been caught, I think, in the initial review process, but again, it was very, very subtle, was the fact that two photomicrographs were really fairly similar, even though their powers, in other words, how enlarged they were differed.
Right.
But it's very subtle, and I think that probably should have been picked up. But ultimately, it actually was picked up by the scientific community, admittedly post-publication, but could have been picked up before. However, one of the problems when you're dealing with a completely brand-new discovery, which is usually what a prestigious journal wants to publish, there is not a whole lot of prior experience to go on unless the data that happens to be submitted or a method that gets described is shown in the experience of one of the reviewers to just not be able to have the sensitivity or do what the author claimed.
Right.
However, the key, the most important, and you hit on this is the key. That is only the very first stage of scientific scrutiny. The next stage, and this is what the public has to recognize, is replication, independent replication by an independent lab getting exactly the same results.
Right.
So the truth, so to speak, is not minted until it's been replicated. Now,
right.
Unfortunately, what happens is the public doesn't realize this because the replication doesn't make the headlines.
Right.
The only thing that makes the headlines is the first announcement, but no scientist, quite frankly, ever believes anything until it doesn't become even part of the scientific canon until it's been replicated multiple times by independent laboratories.
Right now, okay,
so let me just finish. So
sure.
There are a lot of data that have been published out there not fraudulent or not with the intent to be fraudulent simply because somebody in good faith perhaps made an error in interpretation or had a less sophisticated method that were published, made headlines, have never been replicated, and have quickly kind of faded into the scientific knowledge, and that includes in the stem cell field.
Yeah.
So let me give you one example.
Okay.
It was not fraudulent at all. A few years ago, there was an announcement that brain cells could become blood, that you could have this changing of one cell type into another cell type.
Right.
Nobody has ever been able to replicate that. And it wasn't done, you know, it was in science. Nobody's ever been able to duplicate that ever in any lab. So therefore, it's not that first paper was fraudulent. There may have been some artifacts or difficult interpretation, but now that concept has disappeared.
And no bad reputational effects are levied against the people who published that paper just because it wasn't replicated. Is that?
Well, I mean,
it doesn't help their reputation. Right.
Yeah, well, I mean, the reputation has nothing to do with dishonesty. So, yes, there is a bad reputation that begins to cling to somebody who keeps on publishing things that can't be replicated.
Right.
You know, there, it's not that he's dishonest, it's not that he's, that he's fraudulent or prevaricator,
right.
There the reputation is he's a sloppy scientist,
right.
Or he produces things that nobody can reproduce, and so to tell you the truth, in the scientific community, getting a reputation of being a sloppy or non-rigorous scientist, or duplicating, or publishing data that cannot be replicated, is probably as much of a slap as calling somebody dishonest.
Okay.
When you're labeled as a dishonest scientist, your career is finished.
Right.
You will never ever publish again.
Right.
When you get a reputation of being a sloppy scientist or producing data that is irreproducible,
right.
Then your career is not finished. You just really have a hard time ever getting things published again because people will always wonder,
right.
Did he really do this experiment carefully?
So ideally, you want to do things first and have it clear how they can be replicated and have them replicated, and then you get a good reputation as being a hardworking, honest, and innovative researcher.
Right, and I think that's exactly what the public, the other scientific community, really needs to demand, and even the newspapers. You know, I think, unfortunately, we live in a tabloid age of science.
Right.
And, it's only the first announcement of anything that kind of grabs the headlines and gets attention. But, again, that's not the important aspect. The next important aspect is then when it's replicated again and again. And so in this particular case with Wang.
Right.
If in fact, so let's say that somehow the problems in he had made it through with his ruse, and it really for some reason hadn't been picked up. And I think it's important to recognize that the people that discovered it were his own collaborators, people in his own lab, people in his own institutions, and a whole group of Korean scientists going over the data with a fine tooth comb.
Right.
Let's say that had not happened.
Right.
His techniques, they would have followed his recipe verbatim,
right.
As detailed in the methods section of the paper.
Right.
And if nobody could replicate it, and that would have happened probably within the next few months, if not already, he would have been discredited not as deceitful, but as not having really done it. Then when they had investigated, perhaps they would have found, well, the reason he didn't do it successfully is not because the technique is wrong or used the wrong measures or innocent errors of methodology. Then it would have come out, well, it can't be replicated because he never did it the first time. He faked the data.
Right. Now, this procedure, this replication process, is what sank cold fusion, because the scientists in Utah made their announcement, but no one, and then everyone rushed to replicate it, but no one could, essentially,
right.
And therefore the whole field fell into disrepute.
Very quickly, too. You know, this
right.
was not something that lingered for years. I think
right.
it was discredited within months.
Right. Now, as an interesting sidelight here, in the period when the discoveries were assumed to be accurate, it occurred to me that Dr. Huang, having made this breakthrough, that American scientists would want to use his methods to move on to the next step, namely learning how to differentiate the customized stem cells into nerve cells and heart cells and so on. And I tried researching that question, and I ended up talking to some Korean export agency to try to find out whether it would be possible to license his procedures. And it turned into a kind of cul-de-sac or a dead end, and there didn't seem to be any way to do that. And perhaps if I had been more attentive, I would have seen that as a red flag, that those procedures were not available for reuse, even on a commercial basis. Should they have been available so that, or did you or other scientists send an email to Dr. Huang and say, how do you do it so we can do it, and what are the patent? Have you patented it? Do we need to pay you royalties to do it? And did the scientific community rush over to try to replicate it in the time between the announcement and the defrocking?
Yeah, there were.
And what did you find?
I want to emphasize too that what Wong had, you know, this was not just a pretend scientific enterprise. It's, you know, sometimes you see movies, you know, in Blazing Saddles where they have the fake town with just cardboard cut-ups
right.
pretending to be the saloon. This was not one of these. He had a proper lab with proper scientists doing work and probably perhaps succeeding at some level. The technique itself might have little bits of tricks, but a lot of it is simply bits of technique that are not patentable or that are not, sometimes not even explainable. It's kind of like trying to teach somebody who's a really good pianist and wanting to know, how can I play like Van Cliburgh?
Well, I think...
You don't, you don't say to him, well, you know, you push the keys harder or things like that. So a lot of groups were thinking, A, of simply collaborating with him, since with huge scientific enterprises, you know, there's a division of labor.
Right.
And differentiating the cells has not been a problem. We, for example, in the scientific community in this country, have gotten really good at differentiating stem cells, at understanding the biology, at transplanting them, at even using them for diseases. So what Wong needed was our expertise to teach him how to use these cells for something.
Right.
What we needed was somebody, without having to reinvent the wheel, somebody who had really already kind of surmounted the technological hurdle just to save us all time. And doing that, of course, some groups had already started sending some postdocs and technicians over to Korea to start working side by side to learn the techniques.
Right.
He had started sending some technicians over to American labs to start teaching there. And there was going to be this whole group of, you know, this growing collaboration, which, as you remember, was going to be called one of the hubs, a worldwide hub. And that's what this was meant to be.
Right.
And, of course, that fell apart. Now, what you hit on the head was probably precisely what may have happened. One, it may have been, despite all of this sharing of technology, that somebody would still come back to the United States and go, you know, I've done absolutely everything they told me to do, and I just can't get it to work.
Well, from what you said during our last conversation, I got the impression that some of these sort of detailed technicians that had come from Dr. Huang's lab and gone to Gerald Shatton's lab in Pittsburgh, through them, the story about the egg donations, prior to the, right. the questions about the validity of the data, but the egg donation question emerged through some sort of informal conversation, information that was brought by these, I think, three Korean researchers in Pittsburgh, and that led Dr. Shatton to pull out of the whole process, and I don't know whether that precipitated greater scrutiny on the part of the South Korean scientists you mentioned about the scientific validity of the work, and it seems more of a very much a tabloid kind of process rather than a rigorous examination in an effort to replicate the results that led to the unraveling of all this. Would that be a valid conclusion?
No, you know, I don't think so. I think there's multiple levels. I think what happens, you know, as you know, science is based on trust. You have to, you know, the public trusts scientists. Scientists have to trust their peers, and collaborators have to trust each other. And I think what happened was, because so much in a collaboration is based on trust between people working on different aspects of a project, what happened was, I believe, that Wong had assured Shatton about the source of the egg donation.
Right.
But that was one level of trust.
Right.
When it came out that Wong had perhaps lied to Shatton about this aspect,
right.
I believe Shatton said, well, if I can't trust my collaborator in this aspect, can I trust anything that he's done or anything, any of the data he's given me to analyze?
Right.
And I think that's what started the unraveling. And in fact, Shatton was not the first scientist to have some difficulties. You know, even Peter Aldiss at Nature, who is one of the, at Nature magazine, a year before, after the 2004 paper, had unearthed some suspicions about the source of the egg donations.
Right.
Wong, of course, denied that, and, you know, virtually under oath denied that. So, you know, I think, again, one, until evidence to the contrary emerges, you know, you have to take somebody at its word, particularly if it's, you know, virtually under oath.
Okay, let's pull back a little and talk about this, the impact of this on the scientific enterprise generally, and its reputation as an institution. Do you think that this is going to undermine what I imagine is a certain level of public confidence in the scientific project, enterprise, and community?
I think it might, but it shouldn't. You know, I think, as I mentioned before, here's actually an example of where the process worked. You have to realize, here's a paper that came out in May, and within less than 6 months...
It's been discredited.
It had been discredited with other scientific data. So
right.
This was policed and unearthed by the scientific community doing what it does best, looking at every little aspect of the data, scrutinizing it, and coming to its own conclusions at various aspects, everywhere from the journal itself to his colleagues to the scientific community at large and to the broader stem cell community.
So the lesson...
Now, again, as we talked about, should the reviewers have caught some of these problems during the review process? I think maybe, but on the other hand, I've also heard that, and here's an example of how somebody who knows the system can get the system, and if you have an intent to deceive, you can fool the system. It could well be that the figures that the reviewers saw
right.
were different, and then at the very last galley stage,
right.
where now simply the scientist is simply dealing with the printer,
right.
somebody who has an intent to deceive can insert different photos.
Okay.
So now, you would say, well, if he was going to do that, why insert photos that are actually going to blow the whistle?
Right.
And, you know, who knows?
Okay.
Yeah, I think, you know, again, I don't want to play pop psychologist.
Right.
But I think Wong did not begin in this process to deceive. I think he found himself getting caught up in this in the swirl of attention in a very fast-moving, high-profile field. I think he received an enormous amount of pressure from the government to publish prematurely. I think he probably had maybe achieved some of the things that he wanted to achieve, like successfully transferring nuclei and getting at least some proliferation of these cells.
Right.
I think there were problems, as there always are in any kind of scientific process, and he was hoping that, and I think he probably, or as any good scientist, would have wanted to take another year to really work out those bugs, try to reproduce it himself, and I think that the government, I think the rock star status that he himself had become caught up in clouded the judgment, and he just prematurely got this published to a scientific community that knew that this could be done. This is not a process that we think is impossible to do.
Right.
So it really is a race. It's been done with every other mammal, and it seems very unlikely that human is going to be the only mammal where this cannot be done. And we're not talking about, obviously, we're not talking about cloning human beings. All we're doing is talking about a cell line that has a genetic profile similar to something else. So it's a technologically difficult thing to do, but we all know that it's not likely to be impossible.
So what,
therefore, it's a race.
So what,
yeah. Huang wanted to win the race.
Right. What you're saying then is that the takeaway from this should be the system worked rather than scientists are trying to fool people.
Oh, right. Okay. Right. I mean, and in terms of the... So I think the system, a system that operates with well-versed, good, rigorous peers will catch it. And if they don't catch it initially because somehow somebody's been able to play the system, it's going to be revealed as soon as somebody tries to replicate it.
Is there any problem what you were just talking about? If it's a true breakthrough into uncharted territory, there aren't going to be any peers to review it. You touched on that earlier, isn't it?
I don't think that's true. I think that nobody, except maybe Einstein, ever makes a leap into a completely new paradigm that somebody has no experience with.
It's essentially incremental, then.
Yes, it's very incremental. So, there are peers who understand the process of what needs to be done.
Right.
And if it's a technologically... So, in a peer review process, for example, and let's use this as an example... Many people have been trying to do this. They don't receive the financial and personnel support that Huang did, but many people are trying to do this. And there will always be this one obstacle, let's say, that, the cells stop dividing, or the cells die, or or not all the genes get expressed. Let's use that as an example.
Right.
If Huang now says, hey, my cells are now dividing, or I'm not getting my particular gene program shut down, somebody will understand he has made this incremental improvement, and they would say to him quite pointedly, I've done this, and this. Dr. Huang, what is it now that you are adding?
Right.
And if he adds something that sounds quite plausible,
right.
Oh, I changed the pH, or I'm now growing in a lower CO2, or I've added this growth factor, or I've used this chemical, and if it sounds plausible, they'll say, "Oh, that's very clever. Let's try that as well."
Right.
If he said something like, "Well, I just had a Big Mac before I came to work that day,"
right?
People would say, "Well, that doesn't explain it." Or, "Well, I've tried that too, and it doesn't work."
Right. Okay.
And then it would get rejected. And what the public also has to realize is how many papers never get published. Despite all of the ludicrous and extravagant claims that scientists around the world will write up and submit to journals, I would say that in a journal like Science, probably for every paper that does get published, probably 1,000 are rejected.
So,
seriously.
So overall, are there steps that could be taken or that you think ought to be taken to shore up the process, or do you think that the process is fundamentally capable now of detecting a fraud or inaccuracy?
Yeah, I think the process really works quite well, and I think all it takes is one of these episodes to actually have people become even, you know, the reviewers become even more rigorous. I think what you'll actually see is probably a backlash where reviewers are going to be even more suspicious of unfortunately, probably any Korean scientist submitting anything.
Right.
But almost any scientist.
Is there a danger now that good discoveries will go unpublished, or will they need to have higher, by raising the bar, does that mean that some good science is going to go unpublished?
Well, I think if you have a high bar, it can't possibly be, it may be good, but maybe not good enough. So, yeah, I think you're right. In my view, and in most scientists' view, you can never be too demanding in your quest for perfection.
Okay.
I think that maybe the bar will be higher so that there may be some promising studies that don't get published. But then if you're a good scientist, what you do is you hear what it is that now is demanded to leap over the bar. You go back and you get it.
Okay.
So it may be that it's not that good studies don't get published. It'll be that good studies don't get published as quickly.
Okay. I think we pretty well dealt with the impact of this on the scientific process. I want to transition to specific discussion about stem cell and what the non-existence of this breakthrough now means for the stem cell research enterprise. But I sort of wanted to transition through a discussion of this point. There was a big stem cell science symposium set up by the Proposition 71 organizations a few months ago, and it was held in San Francisco, and a speaker there called opponents of Prop 71 funding anti-science. And so my question to you is, do you think that this chain of events, or this series of unfortunate events, strengthens flat earthers, creationists, intelligence designers, and other people who have an interest in discrediting the scientific process?
Well, no, I think it actually, to my view, says that it's even more of an argument to get the Prop 71 money going, because...
Okay. Explain why.
As long as American... You know, I think American scientists still are probably the most rigorous, most innovative, and most savvy scientists in the world. The scrutiny and the amount of regulation and codes of conduct that are in place for American scientists are probably more rigorous than anyone in the world. And I think when you tell American scientists that they have to sit on the sidelines, that they can't engage in this area of investigation, or they can't engage in it with a vigor and a rigor that they're used to applying to other areas, that you're asking for trouble. You're asking for a Wong situation. You're abdicating your role in the scientific community, and you're driving it out into another country where it can't be scrutinized until it's too late.
So you're saying...
So I think that with Prop 71 funding, we and other labs would be working on this very, very assiduously, and we probably would conquer the technological hurdles and be able to move ahead quite readily. And Prop 71 has so many levels of scrutiny and oversight built into it that this kind of thing would never have happened.
So you're saying, in fact, that the delay in funding Prop 71 created the pressure or the opportunity for the forces at work, psychological, sociological, political, that you cited as being involved in the generation of this scandal?
Right. I would say that government... You know, this kind of government involvement, so in the South Korean situation, government involvement actually was somewhat complicit in pushing Wong to publish prematurely. In this country, government involvement and then any of the holding up of Prop 71 fundings has really held up our group scientists from pursuing this. So I think that Prop 71 is doing actually holding up Prop 71 funding is doing a disservice to the scientific community and to the patients and to knowledge in general. We need to be in the game.
Okay. Here's a question. Does the fact that what Dr. Huang said happened didn't happen mean that human cloning defined as the derivation of, in this case, the derivation of stem cells from blastocysts, and the creation of customized human stem cell lines is harder to do than it was thought previously to this series of events to be.
Well, I think the technique is probably, we all knew that it was a very difficult, low-efficiency technique. And again, I want to emphasize it's just one technique. Now, no scientist ever wants to know that they don't have every single arrow in their quiver that they can use against a problem. So even though it's not a technique that we would use a lot, we certainly want to know that when we want to reach for it, it's there. However, there are a few things that, as the science is starting to develop, that we're starting to learn that it may be that human embryonic stem cells are not as immunogenic as we thought. In other words, they may not be rejected by the immune system as readily as we all feared. There's a growing body of evidence that we may not even need patient-specific cell lines. But
well,
again, we don't know.
There are stem cell lines that can be generated and are being generated from leftover embryos, right?
Oh, that, in fact, that's how 99% of the lines are made.
And are those being differentiated now into pancreatic and
nerve? Yep. I mean, that is the area of research that we're all doing.
And, what you're saying is that they may not be as immunogenic as previously thought. Is there any
right.
Are there any results
right.
about that yet? Is that what you're working on as we speak?
I mean, we and other people are working on it. There's some papers in press that demonstrate that, and we, working in the neural stem cell field, have long ago demonstrated that stem cells in the same species, or even sometimes stem cells across species, do not get rejected, and you don't need to use immunosuppression. So for many, many years, we've published data showing that in the brain, for example, immunorejection is really not that much of a problem.
Oh.
So I think that, and now that insight is starting to spill over into the embryonic stem cell field, and so it could be, as knowledge starts expanding, that patient-specific cell lines may not be the end-all and be-all that we thought. It could be that the cells are not rejected as we initially feared, or that we may be able to do just some very clever immunosuppression so that the cells are masked to the patient's immune system.
So if that turns out to be the case, all of this back and forth with Dr. Huang will have turned out to have been more or less irrelevant.
Exactly, exactly. Okay. Second, in terms of making models of disease,
right.
which is another use of nuclear transfer.
Right.
Well, there are many ways to make models of disease. For example, one could actually, and this is something we're actively doing, very often, as you know, there's a process called pre-implantation genetic diagnosis,
right.
PGD.
Right.
And in IVF clinics, very often families will undergo this procedure so that they often do not have a new child who had a deadly, lethal disease like a previous child did. And that's
right.
one of the reasons sometimes families do IVF. Well, these leftover embryos actually would be immoral to implant them.
Right.
They would get destroyed, but they could be a great source of stem cell lines for study.
Wouldn't they have that? Wouldn't they have that lethal genetic predisposition, though?
No, that's exactly the point. These would be models of disease that you could then use in a
okay.
dish
right.
to study drugs or study their pathophysiology. So that was one of the other techniques that nuclear transfer thought to be good for, and it still is. It's still one thing one would want to try, but it's not the only way to make models of disease.
As long as we're there in that eight-celled embryo, there was some discussion a few months ago about taking one of those cells out and using that to generate stem cells, and that the seven-celled entity would develop normally, and that people would then have spare parts available. Has that track moved ahead in any way?
Well, I wouldn't characterize it in that particular fashion. That was more, it was done with mouse cells, so that was more a proof of concept.
Right.
But what it does get to is the third use that nuclear transfer had often been talked about. I talked about number one was to make cells that were matched to a potential transplant recipient.
Right.
Number two was to make these models of disease.
Right.
A third actually was using moving a nucleus back and forth as a technique to avoid some of the ethical dilemmas in stem cell research, which is this notion that you need to destroy a blastocyst, an embryo, in order to make these lines.
Right.
Some groups have found that very morally distasteful, and there is another technique where you can actually move a nucleus to an egg, get it going enough to make cells, a cell line, but not so much that it even has the feasibility of becoming an intact embryo. This was a way of circumventing some of the ethical dilemmas, and it's a technique that was called altered nuclear transfer.
Right, Dr. Hurlbut was...
So this technique involved doing the same kind of nuclear transfer. So if, in fact, nuclear transfer is a feasible technique, then this alternative technique is feasible. If nuclear transfer is impossible, then this technique falls by the wayside. However, there are other ways of circumventing circumventing the ethical problems and making stem cell lines by other than the traditional way of using an embryo, and you cited one of them. Maybe just pull out one of the cells so that the integrity of the embryo is not really disrupted. Another way is getting these more mature cells to de-differentiate and go back in time. Another is to reprogram some of the nuclei. So there's many other techniques. And in general, what I want to emphasize is that, again, nuclear transfer, as described by Dr. Wong, was one particular tool that had a number of uses, but not the only tool for any one of these uses. There are many other ways of getting to our goal that do not involve nuclear transfer.
Among the procedures that you just mentioned was the reprogramming of adult cells. It was my understanding that's in some sense the holy grail of all this, because it wouldn't involve embryos at all. It was my understanding that this embryonic stem cell research needed to be done as the only way to find out what the steps in the process are in order essentially to work backward from the adult cells. Are you saying that there research is going on and there's a possibility of learning how to reprogram the cells without reference to embryonic stem cells at all? Or does it necessarily require that?
Nope, conceivably, sure. And I think you're right, that would be the holy grail. Because ultimately, I think you hit it right on the head. You are right in everything you just said. It is the holy grail. The only way to understand how to do that is to kind of work backwards. The only way you know where that backwards is to look at development.
Right.
But all of that is true, which means that these areas of research must proceed in parallel and is rooted in fundamental developmental biology. Because even the embryonic stem cell field, the goal is not to use these embryonic stem cells as embryonic stem cells. What you want to do is you want to take these embryonic stem cells and instruct them into being something that you find desirable.
Right.
That usually means getting them to mature, but getting them to mature under your guidance into what you think is useful. The virtue of the embryonic stem cell is, one, it just creates this endless supply of cells, so you don't need to keep going back to the well.
Right.
And two, they have the potential to go down many organ pathways.
They're pluripotent. Now, another
way
of
doing this...
Yes. Yeah. They're pluripotent. That's what they
can do. Yeah, they're pluripotent. Now, ultimately, what you want to do is you want to take a pluripotent cell and turn it in... a pluripotent embryonic stem cell and turn it into what I like to call a multipotent somatic stem cell. So, in other words, a stem cell that still has an enormous amount of plasticity, but at least knows now it's meant to live in a particular organ system. It knows now, oh, my address is the nervous system, not the heart, not the muscle.
Okay.
Or another somatic stem cell might be something that's in the blood. My address is the blood, not the muscle.
And the creation of embryonic stem cell lines, pluripotent ones, are necessary before that differentiation process can be observed in the laboratory.
Well, that's one way of doing it. Sometimes another way of doing it is to leapfrog and simply say, well, I don't need the embryonic stem cell. I'm going to go straight into the brain and pull out that somatic stem cell, which is still incredibly plastic, still can give me all the various cells I need in the brain.
And those exist and are in place now in everybody's body.
We're the first ones to have ever grown and isolated that. We discovered that in 1998. And we've used that quite effectively. Now, as in anything in science, there are advantages and disadvantages to each particular approach.
Right.
So the advantage of a somatic stem cell, a neural stem cell, is it's really, really safe. It's never going to give you tumors, and it's only going to give you the cells that are appropriate to the nervous system. The downside is that it's really hard to get a whole lot of them. You really have to flog them to keep them in the cell cycle dividing.
Right.
The embryonic stem cell has the advantage of it's naturally immortalized. It's cranking out, it's dividing all the time.
Right.
So supply there is not a problem. There, the disadvantage is taming the cells so that they give you the cell type that you want and only the cell type that you want, still with a lot of plasticity enough to respond to its environment, and then also taming it enough so that it doesn't give you any kind of tumors or inappropriate cell type, so it doesn't give you bone in your brain.
Right. Are you saying that somatic nerve stem cells are capable of generating new, useful nerve cells, but the problem is that they don't reproduce themselves very rapidly?
Right. They can, and they will, but they don't do it with the rapidity of embryonic stem cells. So I'll give you a perfect example.
Right.
We do a lot of work in primate models of Parkinson's disease.
Right.
So a real health condition plaguing, thousands and thousands of Americans.
And Parkinson's is pretty well understood now. It's the failure of the dopamine production on the part of the nerve cells.
Let's put it this way. There's still a hell of a lot that we don't know about Parkinson's disease. However, I think we at least have an understanding of the cell type that seems to be the problem. So
right.
You're right in that regard. So a disease that has some semblance of understanding.
Right.
There's a great model of it that is about as close as you're going to come to the human condition.
Right.
As any animal model. It's actually in a monkey, and it really emulates real humans with the disease, and it's a major problem in the United States.
Right.
Now, monkeys are big. When we know that we're getting ready to do transplants in some of these monkeys, we usually take a few weeks in anticipation to scale up our neural stem cells to give us enough cells to go into enough monkeys to be able to do the experiment.
Right.
So we need a lead time of maybe a few weeks, at least 2 weeks to build up enough cells.
Right.
Embryonic stem cells, you only need a lead time of maybe sometimes a few days.
Right.
Because they're dividing so quickly.
Well, are you presumably looking into the difference between the embryonic stem cells and the somatic nerve cells to find out why the nerve cells are not so robust?
Well, yes, we are. I wouldn't use the word robust. I would just say that, some of the advantages of why their cell cycle, it really does come down to cell cycle length. So somatic stem cells divide, but they, their cell cycle may be as much as 72, 96 hours.
Right.
In humans.
Right.
But they're safe.
Right.
Embryonic stem cells maybe have a cell cycle of 48 hours.
Right.
And, they divide much more quickly, but the price that you pay for rapidly dividing cells is that sometimes they spin off cells that have chromosomal abnormalities. They take a lot more effort to tame them, so to speak.
Okay.
And so the answer is yes, we're comparing them side by side to figure out how they differ, what genes are different, what is the difference in their cell cycle, and we're taking it even a step further. We're taking these cells and putting them into the exact same disease models and looking side by side to see which one's better, which one works better, which one's safer, which one's easier to work with, which gives you better results in cures and things like that.
Okay. And let's come full cycle again. And what's the importance of unblocking the $3 billion in Proposition 71 money to facilitate that research? Or can that research be carried on absent that $3 billion?
Well, funding is the mother's milk of research. And to get work done, you need hands, you need people, you need brains, and we can't devote the energy, the people power, to this effort without the money to fund them, to pay their salaries, which is why somebody like Wong was able to kind of catapult to the forefront of this area, because his government was giving him every bit of funding that he needed to hire lots of people. So I think that if the electorate wants good, safe, effective, ethical research, they really have to let the $3 billion flow so that we can hire the best minds in the world to start working on this.
Based on what you just said, how important to the whole process is the training of new researchers, and what, if anything, do you know about the status of the ICOC training grants, which in fact have been issued but without any money behind them?
I think that training good young scientists is the key. I mean, ultimately, we need a generation of scientists who are trained in the biology. And no young scientist is going to go into a field that doesn't pay him a salary or that he thinks is going to be a dead end. So we'll lose those people. The training grants were, you know, you're exactly right. They've been written. The infrastructure is all set up. And in fact, we are doing the training. But we're doing it, we're not enlisting new trainees. We're only using trainees that are already in the system, or that can come with other kinds of funding,
okay,
either government funding or private funding.
Okay. What impact, if any, do you think this incident in South Korea is going to have on the debate in Congress about the various bills to fund or ban or otherwise regulate embryonic stem cell research, if any?
Well, you know, I think it's going to be a political football, and you can probably guess as well as I can what's going to happen. The opponents of stem cell research are going to use this as a club to beat over the head of the stem cell researchers or the members of Congress who are pro-stem cell research as an example of how scientists cannot be trusted. I think that would be a wrong way to use this incident. I think that the other side, and of which I include myself, would say when the United States of America sits on the sidelines of a very important area of biology that's clear to move the boundaries of healthcare. And I call stem cell biology not just embryonic stem cells. I say stem cell biology is a whole discipline of developmental biology and cell therapy. When the United States sits on the sidelines, you allow not only unsavory characters like those in other countries to pick up the ball and run with it, but you're now depriving American electorate, the American public, of real advances in healthcare. Let's say that Wong had actually been right. Let's say he really had done what he said he had done. And now they were the ones who somewhat had a monopoly on this technology, maybe on the cell lines and the techniques. It would be rationed to the American public, and we wouldn't be able to take advantage of it. In some respects, it's almost in an odd kind of way, a blessing that this technology is still up for grabs, and that we American scientists still have a shot at cornering the market on that.
Okay, two last questions here. Has this incident had any impact on your own research?
It has had an impact because we are completely prepared to make some models using human embryonic stem cells to model certain diseases, particularly diseases that are lethal for children.
So you were in line to get some of these apparently non-existent stem cell lines.
Well, it was more than that. We had the technology to understand these diseases. We actually had the nuclei to be able to do the transfer, and we actually had in place the rudiments of a beginning of a collaboration.
Right.
And the Korean group and Dr. Shatton and Dr. Wong, they were going to physically do the transfer for us.
Right.
They were going to make lines that we would then use to study some crippling childhood diseases.
This is along the lines.
When this broke, we had to cut off the collaboration immediately.
This is along the lines of Dr. Ian Wilmot was going to provide motor neuron disease nuclei to Dr. Huang to make cells to for him to study that.
Yeah, in fact, we were all part of the same consortium.
Oh, okay.
Dr. Wilmot was going to be, we were going to be involved in providing things for childhood diseases, and Dr. Wilmot was going to be doing for the motor neuron disease. We were all in this together. This was the beginnings of this large collaboration, and we figured, as in anything in science, there's a division of labor, and everybody
right.
does what they do best, and this, obviously, this collaboration comes to a screeching halt with the revelations that that have come out.
Right, okay. Wrap up by just talking a little bit as much as you want about the stem cell research that, that you're working on now yourself in your lab, that you want to the extent you want to talk about it.
Yeah, I mean, just in general, what I think I like to always tell people who ask me that question is that we consider ourselves to be developmental biologists, and what we try to do is understand what is the natural inclination that the stem cell has. In other words, we view that stem cells were placed there not to give you a show or to give people headlines or money, that stem cells are just part of how nature builds a system and then maintains its function all throughout life. So we try to understand what that language is that the stem cell does at all these various stages, harness that biology, and then apply it to various disease processes, knowing that we also have to understand the disease process. So with that viewpoint, we have a far-ranging view of diseases that we look at because each disease demands something a little bit different. So we look at cancer. We look at stroke. We look at Parkinson's disease and Alzheimer's disease and these childhood diseases that cause mental retardation and spinal cord injury. Each does something a little bit, demands something a little bit different. So what's kind of interesting is the commonalities that hold all of these various diseases together.
Say something more about that.
Well, all stem cells at any system, whether you're talking about a heart system or a brain system or embryonic stem cells, they, again, think to yourself, if you were nature and you wanted to make a system that was on autopilot, that when something goes wrong, the cavalry comes in and tries to fix it, how would you do that?
Right.
So what we learn is that stem cells across systems will home in to where the pathology is. They respond to actually inflammatory cues.
Right.
They then read the environment, and they put out the fire, so they do anti-inflammatory type things. Then they also start making growth factors to try to protect the cells that were already there so that they don't die.
Right.
Then they say, where are the gaps? What cells was I unable to protect?
Right.
Now I'm going to become that kind of cell.
Right.
But I also need chaperone cells around me, so I'm now going to make chaperone cells.
Right.
And this little scenario, and a lot of, most of the time the cells do this even without being instructed to do it. They do it day in and day out. The endogenous cells, the stem cells that are already there, do this. What our job is twofold. One, not to muck up the system, because we think we're more clever than the system itself is.
Right.
And two, to intelligently augment the system when it doesn't do it quite as well as we would like.
By providing, for example, more chaperone cells, huh?
Yeah, maybe providing more chaperone cells or more stem cells or more factors that invite more stem cells to go in there or make it more comfortable for them to live. My little dictum that I think I maybe even said to you at some point in some of our conversations is that even the dumbest stem cell is smarter than the smartest biologist. So what we try to do is understand what it is that the stem cell wants to be doing, understand it, harness it, then exploit it. And this kind of journey takes us to many, many different kinds of disease processes.
Okay.
One of them, for example, is cancer. We believe that cancer is just the flip side of normal development, both involving stem cells. Except in one process, stem cells have gone to the dark side, and in the other, stem cells remain true to their nature and true to their calling.
And you're trying to find out what makes them stay good or go bad.
Exactly. And then maybe, if we're really clever, get the good guys kind of like the Jedi Knights to go after the Darth Vaders.
Right.
So the Jedi Knights that have gone to the dark side and actually use the good stem cells to attack the bad stem cells.
And like Anakin, like the origin of Darth Vader, Anakin, he was a good cell to start with, you see.
Absolutely. That's my model of cancer.
Right, okay. All right, well, I want to thank you very much for talking to us and elucidating this, and I hope maybe in the future we can even put together some more presentations about some of the details here and maybe refer to some other people who know a lot about some of these subspecialties as well and help educate the public about what's actually involved with the whole stem cell process, make it a little less opaque to everyone.
Sure, I'll be glad to do that.
Okay, well, thanks very much for talking to us today.
Okay, thanks for inviting me.
You're welcome. Bye.
Bye-bye.